What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal points and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Don't forget the current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
And we welcome you into Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside, the Legal Eagles in studio here at the Tribune Tower. My name is Sam Panionovich. Plenty to get to on the show today. We'll talk to an attorney out of New York who wrote a book called Broken Scales. We'll discuss the Illinois Democrats' minimum wage proposal, also the legal grab bag, as we always do at the end of the show. But we start with Alderman Amaya Pawar, who is joining us from his 47th ward here in Chicago, the website Pawar2018.com. He's running for governor. Hello, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Alderman, thanks for joining us. House Bill 40 is proposed legislation here in the state that would ensure that abortion would remain legal even if the Supreme Court rolls back Roe v. Wade. Of course, we've got a new president who has talked about rolling back Roe v. Wade. We've got a new Supreme Court with Justice Gorsuch. Many are speculating that he will be adverse to Roe v. Wade, and there might be at least one or two more vacancies in the Trump administration that could be filled by pro-life candidates. So tell us your feelings about House Bill 40 and specifically Governor Rauner's threat to veto that legislation.
You know, look, we've already had this debate in this country around abortion and a woman's right to choose and reproductive and her reproductive rights. We've had this debate in the state. And all HB 40 does is remove the anti-choice trigger language from the 1975 Act and also make sure that, you know, while we roll that trigger language back, that we also ensure that there's real equity in access. And that means that if someone works for or accesses a state employee health insurance, they also have access. And that if someone is on Medicaid, they also have access. This is really just about equity and rolling back a dangerous trigger provision.
So you're running for governor. You're a Democrat. As Sam mentioned, you're in your second term as alderman. Bruce Rauner is a Republican. He has come out and said that he will veto this legislation. That is after saying that he was pro-choice when he was a candidate. You obviously feel that Rauner is now changing his position. Tell us about your feelings on that.
I mean, I think this is consistent with a lot of other Governor Rauner sort of talks over the last 2 years. You know, he says he's for one thing and then he actually does another. He was for a woman's right to choose and a woman's right to control her reproductive rights. And then now he's saying he's going to veto that. He wants fair and competitive elections with redistricting reform, and yet he vetoes automatic voter registration. So, you know, he's got a whole 2 years worth of inconsistencies.
How likely do you think Roe v. Wade will be rolled back? On the one hand, you know, you could look at prior rulings and say that Roe v. Wade in some respects has been scaled back a little bit. Casey is one example. On the other hand, you know, many are looking at Gorsuch as someone who will not overturn that precedence. He's very much a believer in precedence. He voted in the majority a great, I think it was 85% of the time. I know you're not a constitutional scholar or anything, but how do you foresee this being played out on the federal level?
I mean, the president might have an opportunity to nominate one more justice. At least one more, potentially. And so I think what we're talking about doing here in Illinois is just striking a dangerous trigger provision and not waiting for any adverse action at the federal level. You know, we have states' rights. We can do this. We don't need permission from the federal government. This is all something we can handle in the legislature with the governor's signature. And I think we should be doing that. This is just the right thing to do. I'm not really quite sure why there's such a prolonged debate about this. This is a simple thing to do. And I think the governor is continuing to dig himself into holes by saying he's for one thing and then doing another. He's done this on a number of issues. This is an easy thing for him to do, and he gets to put this behind him and move forward and pass a budget.
Why is there Why is this legislation now, why is there a sense of urgency around it in our state?
I mean, look, Maryland recently took similar action and also made sure to expand access for women who are in Medicaid because of the president's dangerous actions to deny Planned Parenthood funding. I think, you know, we know that the president has a has an agenda. He does not believe in funding Planned Parenthood. And for lots of small towns and rural communities, Planned Parenthood is the only option for primary medical care. So Maryland took action to protect their constituents, and I think Illinois should follow suit. And that's what a lot of states are going to be doing this. And so it's not as if, you know, people are waiting to line this up and tee this up around politics necessarily. This is also, and more importantly, a gender equity, a human rights issue that we should be resolving today.
And according to most reports, many of the Illinois has, let me put it this way, the Midwest has some of the toughest abortion restrictions in the nation. Many people are coming to Illinois from other states, the primary other state being Indiana, which happens to be the home of Vice President Mike Pence. Do you see any correlation there?
Yeah, I mean, look, I just don't understand why allowing a woman to control her reproductive rights, to be in control of what happens with her body, is something that we continually debate over and over and over again. It's everyone is so obsessed with what someone does with their reproductive rights. But when the child is born, all of a sudden they say, well, now you've got bootstraps, take care of yourself. Everyone's obsessed with what happens pre-birth, but once the child is born, all of a sudden, and if they're born into a poor family, no one wants to talk about how to support that poor family. It's just the inconsistencies in our political discourse is just, it's maddening. But, you know, it is what it is. We have an opportunity here to do the right thing. The governor 2 years ago was on the right side of the issues. He just needs to come back to the right side of the issue.
Alderman, when did you first know that you were going to run for governor?
I think the November election played a big role in me jumping into the race.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us here in Chicago. That's Alderman Ameya Pawar from the 47th Ward in Chicago. Good luck, and keep us posted down the road.
Thank you for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Rolling right along here on Legal Face-Off, WGN Radio with Rich and Jason. Joining us now on the phone, a professor and director for the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He also does work in Chicago as well. Professor Robert Bruno, good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Professor. This is a big day for legislative topics on Legal Face-Off. There's a national push that we've covered extensively on this show by unions and worker advocates for a $15 minimum wage. Illinois Democrats have come out and announced plans for a very ambitious hike in the minimum wage during the spring legislative session. Of course, Governor Rauner has voiced opposition to any kind of increase. The proposal is to raise the state's minimum wage from the current level of $8.25 to $15 over the next 5 years. This is a more ambitious plan than previous adjustments in Illinois. You have authored a study on the impact of a raise in the minimum wage. Tell us your perspective on how that would affect families and the economy in general.
Yes, well, thanks. We've done a couple of studies looking at this issue. Most recently, one that looked at the impact that it would have, raising the minimum wage to different levels would have on housing affordability. And ultimately, what we find is that raising that minimum wage would dramatically reduce the housing burden that people experience in this state. It would have an impact on raising incomes, average incomes. It would have an impact on increasing the productivity of workers working currently in a variety of different industries. It would reduce turnover of those workers in that industry. It would have a net positive effect on tax contributions, which suggest also a lowering on the burden on the state in having to subsidize people who are low wage. We also looked at, what would the impact likely be maybe on employment? And we found that statistically there was little to no impact on jobs. There would perhaps be some reduction in some low-wage jobs, but then there would be an increase in jobs that would be better paying as a result. And our studies largely align with research that's been done in other states and localities looking at the impacts of minimum wage increase.
And specifically, your report found that 34%, at least 34% of Illinois mm-hmm. workers earn less than $15 an hour. You also projected that an increase to $15 would result in less than a 1% employment decline, but yield an extra $2.4 billion in tax revenue.
Yeah.
So if that is correct, why is there such opposition? And Jason's going to ask you about some of the opposition here, but why is there such opposition to a tax increase?
So we have heard the critique about how somehow raising the minimum wage would negatively impact profitability, employment growth, the state of the overall economy. Maybe it would intimidate employers to expand production because the cost of labor would go up. But quite frankly, that critique is the same critique we've always heard about any kind of employment policy that's ever been developed, actually, and proposed in the United States. And we can actually go back to the progressive era, and you'll find very similar kinds of allegations, except that the data just never really supports it. So it seems to me that you get these critiques, quite frankly, because employers are just very, very hesitant to lose control of costs or to have any additional restraints on their ability to unilaterally establish cost of labor. So it seems really to come from that sort of desire to control as much as possible the cost of labor.
Right, and obviously there's some business groups like the Chamber of Commerce and some of the other organizations that have come out against this. And you point out, some of it is they want control over the wages. Don't they just pass on any of these increases to the consumer anyway?
Well, good question. So they can do a bunch of different things, and that's what the research really suggests. They could, and we actually assumed, that they might pass on some of that cost, that they aren't going to allow it to eat their profits. And when we've seen this, and when these studies, when other studies have been done doing the same thing, suggesting there might be a modest pass-through of cost to the consumer, what we find is that the businesses continue to profit, and they don't lose business. McDonald's just recently has come out, one of the best profit reports that they've had in quite a while, and they've increased cost. So they could do that. They could do some other things. They could not increase costs. They could simply say that a somewhat smaller share of the revenue generated would go to profits or dividends, and that would be a good outcome. That would be a good place to be. They could also increase productivity through, you know, through training. There might be some capital substitution. They might say, well, the cost of labor is too great. Maybe I'm going to find some technology that's going to help me. So there could be some displacement, or they could reallocate the way in which they compensate their workforce. So there could be a sort of a different mix of compensation levels. So they can do a whole bunch of things. But quite frankly, what we know is, regardless of what they do, businesses do not suffer. They don't run away. You know, they don't leave the jurisdiction. Their workers are more productive. There's more just general economic activity being developed because of there are so many low-wage jobs in Illinois, and tax revenues go up. So there's very little downside to doing this.
Is it better to have this this wage increase come through incrementally or all at once?
Another really good question. So, you know, at small incremental increases, you know, something that goes up a dollar and a half or so, there really isn't any need to incrementally introduce this. Quite frankly, if the increase is too modest and you spread it out over too long of time, by the time you hit that top dollar figure, you no longer know whether it's going to have a positive impact, depending on the cost of living. You might have eaten it all up by that point. So I certainly don't recommend that we have these scaled, tiered steps to reaching a modest increase. If you get to $15, it's been suggested that, well, maybe you want to allow an incremental a period. But quite frankly, I don't really see the argument for that. I mean, even at 15, we're still talking about somebody who's earning less than $30,000 if they're working a full time, So I don't really see the argument to tier it. And I don't really think that the employment outcomes are going to justify it.
He's Robert Bruno, professor and director for the Labor Education Program at University of Illinois. And to learn more, very simple, just Google Project for Middle Class Renewal. That's Project for Middle Class Renewal. Thank you so much for your time here on WGN.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
We welcome you back to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Joining us now on the phone from New York, an attorney from Strzok, Strzok & Levin, he is Joel Cohen, and he also is an author. He wrote the recent book, Broken Scales, Reflections on Injustice. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Joel, thanks. You're a former prosecutor with the New York State Special Prosecutor's Office. You also worked with the U.S. Department of Justice's Organized Crime and Racketeering Section in the Eastern District of New York. You're a veteran of prosecutions. You've certainly seen your share of cases of injustice. What prompted you to write a book about examples of that kind of injustice?
Well, needless to say, the experience one has over the course of a career, both as I was a longtime prosecutor and much longer so as a defense lawyer, you can tend to get sensitive to things that have gone on in your career where there may be injustices or near injustices, and then you take a broader look of yours being a microcosm of what really goes on in the criminal justice system in America. And I had previously written a book also published by the ABA, which looked into, this sounds a little arrogant, but looked into the minds of judges in terms of how they decide cases. And this was a follow-up. That was interviews of judges. This is interviews of folks who have been involved in injustices in one way or another. And their lives have been impacted by those injustices. And these are interviews with these folks to see what's gone on with them that may present a broader reflection of injustice in America.
So through these interviews with the participants in the justice system, most of whom, as you say, were victims of injustice, is there a common strain that you took away from your interviews? In other words, was the injustice related to class, race, where they were located, how their attorneys were? What was, if any, the common denominators between these different victims of injustice?
You know, it's a very good question, and the truth of the matter, and I grappled with it in an introduction of the book and in the epilogue to it, that there isn't that necessary cohesion between all of the injustices. They affected people in different ways, and these people were different people. They're not only defendants who were wrongly convicted or stuff like that, but actually one is about a prosecutor who wrongly convicted a man in Shreveport, Louisiana, who did 30 years in jail. Ultimately, this prosecutor finds out, he's no longer a prosecutor, finds out that the guy is exonerated 30 years later. And this prosecutor is living with the fact that he participated unwittingly in an injustice against a man who served 30 years, literally 30 years on death row before he died soon after his exoneration. That as opposed to another young man relatively in Connecticut who was prosecuted and then exonerated completely innocent after 20 years. And that guy tells his story in this book about how his life was affected by it and how he's trying to put his life back together. Now he's in his early 40s, having suffered that injustice. But so the injustices are different, and there's not necessarily a common denominator for them.
Joel, throughout all your research and your experience as both a prosecutor and on the defense side now, and writing this book, would you say that our legal system is fair, the justice system is fair, or are there improvements that can be made upon it?
There are certainly improvements that can be made. I'm blessed with many good friends. The one who has done more with his life than anyone I know is Barry Scheck. He has literally taken, I think, 40 or 45 people off of death row who are literally innocent, completely innocent, actually innocent. And if that happens to 40 people that he knows about and was able to get exonerations for them, imagine how many injustices go on in America every day, and the system needs to be repaired. I'm probably not equipped to say how that system should be repaired, but I'm hoping with the book to start that national conversation that others have already started in different ways around America.
Joel, what always fascinates me when I read about injustices is the degree to which the prosecutors, through sometimes really small decisions, could impact, you know, someone's life in some extents, you know, for 30 years, like you mentioned, or even worse. As a former prosecutor and through your interviews, how much of this injustice is simply based on prosecutors, you know, being so far down the road with a case, for example, and not having the, you know, ability or having their egos, you know, not allowing their egos to affect their judgment and, you know, not reversing themselves when the evidence presents? How much of this is just due to plain, you know, human behavior on the part of some prosecutors that is pretty egregious in some cases?
I think that there's a lot of it. One of the cases I discussed in the book involved actually Ted Cruz, who was almost won the nomination to be president of the United States. Ted Cruz was the Solicitor General at the time of the state of Texas, and some guy for a relatively low felony crime, I'm sorry, misdemeanor crime, was prosecuted, could have gotten as a maximum sentence in the case 2 years. The judge didn't pick it up. The prosecutor didn't pick it up. His not particularly competent criminal lawyer didn't pick it up, and the judge sentenced him to 14 years. Everybody in the system recognized that the sentence was wrong, but Ted Cruz pursued the case to the Supreme Court of the United States to tell the Supreme Court you shouldn't allow this sentence to be reduced in an appeal from his conviction because in that case he was pursuing his habeas corpus remedy too late, and there was precedent that wouldn't have allowed it. I mean, when you think about it, that a prosecutor actually knows in that case that the guy shouldn't have gotten more than 2 years, and two justices of the Supreme Court questioning Cruz, who was arguing the case in the Supreme Court, like, can't you confess error? Why don't you just confess error? And, you know, Cruz is a very able lawyer. He sort of got around the question, and he says, well, there's a precedent involved, and the justice of the Supreme Court, I think it was Stevens, said to him, yeah, but you're trying to maintain the precedent on the back of a guy who should have only gotten 2 years and actually got 14 years. It doesn't make sense. And I don't think that was a case of arrogance or he was too far down the road with the case, Cruz. He was more interested in preserving a precedent than seeing that justice be done in the case.
Joel, did you watch the O.J. Simpson documentary on ESPN that got?
I did.
Yeah. So what really struck me among the, you know, many, many things, and we cover that extensively, and I thought it was one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. What struck me was the interviews with the jury in the murder trial who stated on camera. I mean, there was that older woman and there was the other female who stated unequivocally that they came to this decision not based on the evidence, but simply as retribution for the Rodney King perceived injustice. You know, as a former prosecutor and as someone who's an expert in injustice, I don't know how you reacted. I was just angry. I was, you know, I was incredibly angry that that happened. And we all sort of suspected that, but to have these two people who decided this way and affected so many lives simply as retribution for something else, to me, goes to the heart of injustice.
Well, it's sort of a good thing, but also a bad thing in the jury system that you find jurors who are making decisions having nothing to do with the facts because they come to the jury room with a baggage that's sometimes very hard to weed out in the jury selection process. It's sort of interesting in terms of the you asked before whether or not there is some common denominator to the injustices. One of the cases I discussed is about the former Chief Justice of Iowa. Her name is Turnus. She's literally the chief judge at the time of Iowa, and the case of same-sex marriage came before her and the court before the Supreme Court decided it was unconstitutional across the board, a ban on same-sex marriage. She knew going into deciding the case, if she decided in favor of same-sex marriage, there would be substantial money coming, you know, from right-wingers outside of Iowa that would beat her in a recall vote that would happen if she were to decide the case that way. She decided, and two other justices who were up for recall also decided the case in favor of same-sex marriage. They were then voted out. They were voted out because they did the right thing. Whether you agree with same-sex marriage or not, they voted what they thought the law was in that. That's an injustice, too, and that kind of thing goes on in the American justice system, totally different than the O.J. case or the Texas case or the Shreveport case or the Connecticut case that I've been talking about. The common denominator is you can be at different parts of the spectrum in the justice system and be the victim of an injustice, as was that judge.
That's Joel Cohen. He's an experienced white-collar criminal lawyer at Strzok Strzok & Levin. In the book, check it out on Amazon, Broken Scales, Reflections on Injustice. Thank you for your time here in Chicago.
Thank you.
It's time for the Legal Grab Bag on Legal Face Off, WGN, WGNRadio.com. Rich and Jason, former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. will no longer get to see divorce case in Cook County Court.
Yeah, he decided to not proceed yesterday in Chicago. His wife was proceeding in D.C. He was proceeding in Chicago. His wife was proceeding in D.C. And yesterday, his lawyers released a statement saying that the case is too divisive, and
that's a Canadian pronunciation.
Yes, divisive is from Canada. And also, obviously, the legal fees are mounting up. Divorce cases are some of the most expensive that you can find. So he's dropping the Chicago case. A lot of this was due to the tactics of Sandy Jackson, his ex-wife, soon-to-be ex-wife's lawyers, where they asked him to disclose the names of all of his sexual partners during their marriage. That was obviously going to be very embarrassing.
Well, it's no big deal if you just say none, right?
Right, but, you know, there's this little thing called an oath that you take when you answer discovery. So,
no, I'm saying if you say the truth, if the truth is none, right. But if you have something to hide.
Exactly, it's true. So, you know, that was a big reason why he didn't. So there's a hearing on Friday of this week where they're going to be discussing further proceedings, including child support. But the big news is this case will not proceed in Chicago anymore.
Don't the kids reside still in D.C.? I mean, they all do, right?
So, yeah.
So let's talk about Dennis Hastert, another person we've talked about extensively on the show, the former U.S. House Speaker. He has now been stripped of his pensions here in Illinois.
Yeah, he was stripped of the Illinois pension. It paid him about $755 a month. And since he had the felony conviction and serving 15-month prison federal sentence for the bank fraud charge, they determined that they would strip that from him. The state teacher's retirement system had already yanked about $2,400, well, the bulk of $2,400 he was receiving from the state after the conviction. So still going downhill, but Denny Hastert still has his $73,000 per year pension from the U.S. House of Representatives for the time he
served.
Yeah,
so this one's nothing compared to the one he gets from the U.S. House.
Right, yeah, this was pittance compared to that. So where does it, I wonder where it goes. Does it just go to his house? It can't go right to prison, right? I mean, can't go to the commissary, so
it's
he can
a
get
lot
some,
of cigarettes in the prison. $73,000 a
he's
year.
He's gonna be like what was that guy? Who's the guy who bilked everyone out of billions of dollars? Bernie Madoff.
Yeah.
Who runs like he owns all the pudding and lemonade now in prison, and he's cornered the market on it.
Well, Hastert's story. Hastert's gonna be released in August, so you know there'll be some money from the federal government, from us all taxpayers, waiting for him.
That's good.
State of Arkansas executed two inmates on Monday night. That was after the U.S. Supreme Court actually refused to grant stays.
Yeah, last week we covered this story. The Arkansas governor was pushing to execute, what was it, eight people on death row before the expiration date of these drugs.
Which sounds logical.
Yeah, I mean, why, you know, wait till the last minute and, you know, fill these people full of deathly sedatives. So they went ahead after the Supreme Court, as you mentioned, refused to stay these executions. They went ahead and executed two of the death row inmates. And, you know, one of the issues was, one of the issues always in death penalty cases is whether this amounts to cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Constitution. In this case, one of the inmates who petitioned the court for the stay argued that because he was 400 pounds, it would be difficult for the executioners to find a vein for the lethal injection. In fact, in this execution that took place just a couple of days ago, they only allowed media in after they already started the sedative. So they didn't allow everyone to see some of the line going in. So there's certainly, according to some reports, they had to put a needle into this person's neck. So there was some talk that one of the inmates was still moving his lips, gulping for air during the execution. The state has denied that. But there's certainly a lot of questions about how these executions that take place and whether they're in violation of the Constitution.
A couple interesting points. The U.S. Supreme Court denied a stay request, and our new Justice Neil Gorsuch ruled on that in the five-justice majority that they denied the stay. And Mr. Williams is scheduled today, right, for execution.
Yes.
We love a good lawsuit. So Cincinnati, University of Cincinnati, the former law dean, Jennifer Barge, she was placed on administrative leave after faculty members discussed a vote of no confidence. She has now filed a lawsuit. She wants to sue U of C.
So, yeah, really interesting for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, on the last legal face-off, we had another female law school dean, Dean Jennifer Rosado Perea, here from DePaul Law School. This is a female dean who was in charge of the University of Cincinnati College of Law. She was in the middle or 2 years into a five-year contract. The provost of the university put her on administrative leave after there was a vote of no confidence taken by the law school faculty. There was only about nine of the faculty who voted in favor of this, who were apparently the ones who were proponents of getting rid of her. She said that she was very taken aback by that action. And ultimately, the provost announced that she was permanently going to be replaced. She, in her complaint, said that this disagreement that she had with the faculty was simply the product of normal tension that goes on in law schools all the time. I'm on the board of visitors for my law school, so I'm familiar with these kind of back and forth. And to me, there didn't seem to be any evidence supporting her ouster.
The only thing she can point to is that she had basically disclosed that the law school's operating funds were being used to pay salary supplements for some of the endowed professorships, which they weren't supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, she was hired to reduce the budget,
which
faculty
is part of her
doesn't
job.
Like
yeah.
that. So, you know, they got rid of her.
Yeah.
You know, under her leadership, the law school rose 22 places, according to the 2017 U.S. News and World Report. So I think her lawsuit has some legs. And, you know, it's always interesting when you sort of peel back the curtain here at law schools and see what goes on.
Yeah.
Isn't it strange, though, that she is suing them, but then she also wants to be reinstated? That doesn't usually happen, does it, when you sue somebody and then you want to get the job back?
And it normally causes a lot of strife, and there's conflict. I mean, most of the time they won't reinstate. And the only thing that they'll do is money damages. But if she's under a five-year contract, $300,000 a year salary, she still has till 2020. So, I mean, I don't know. I think the main point is to not disparage her good name so that she can have, you know, a chance somewhere else to get a job without ruining her reputation.
Chicago rapper Chance the Rapper, who grew up on 79th Street on the South Side, is now suing bootleggers over some fake merchandise.
Yeah, CTR Touring and Chance the Rapper, real name is Chancellor Bennett, for those who aren't in the know, has filed a lawsuit against several people who he is accusing of hawking fake Chance the Rapper merchandise during his 2016 tour. Chance has trademarked the name, so he doesn't want them to use it. We've covered this over. NCAA has used that with March Madness and different things where they're trademarked and you're not allowed to sell the merchandise. So we'll see what happens with this lawsuit. But I'm sure these people don't really have a ton of money to pay Chance the Rapper for merchandise.
I want to have a "the" in my name. Chance the Rapper.
Rich the Lenkoff.
Yeah. Rich the podcast host.
Yeah.
Celebrity lawyer can't shake a defamation suit over tweets. Lawsuits and tweets, they go together sometimes.
Yeah, this is Mark Garagos, who is a very well-known celebrity lawyer in his own right. He's been on CNN many times. He's got a long roster of celebrity clients. He is now facing a defamation suit over his tweets implying that Dr. Luke, who I don't think is a medical doctor, but you might know more than I am. I do, Sam. Raped Lady Gaga. This was actually a story that we've covered extensively, and Garagos is now being sued over a series of tweets that the plaintiff alleges imply that this Dr. Luke was a rapist. Garagos wrote, "Guess who the rapist was?" When someone wrote, "Are you insinuating someone that Kesha fans would know of?" Garagos responded with, "Oh, yes." And then when someone wrote Dr. Luke's name in this tweet, he wrote, "Bingo." So, you know, one of the takeaways here is are tweets defamatory? Can you recover against someone for writing these kind of words in tweets? I mean, I think the answer is probably yes.
If you have money.
Possible.
If you have money, then you can
sure.
have a lawsuit filed against you for it. But
You know, Garagos has asserted privilege over some of these documents. So always interesting that the hunter becomes the hunted. This very well-known celebrity lawyer is now the subject of a celebrity lawsuit himself.
Mm. So we close legal grab bag with the wife of Peter Francis Geraci, the Chicago bankruptcy attorney. His wife, Holly, lost a federal lawsuit last week against her condo association, and now she'll have to share the elevators with dogs. She wanted canine-free carriages, but not the case.
Well, yeah, it's kind of ironic, too, that when they moved into the building in 2000, there was a rule that they could not have dogs in there, but the condo association made an exception for them because they had a terrier, which weighed about 10 pounds. Then in 2004, the building opened the door for all kinds of dogs. Ironically, the lawsuit was because Frances Tracy's wife had suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder after being attacked by a German shepherd when she was a child and has a fear of large dogs. So she was trying to get rid of those dogs. When the alternative, she wanted a special elevator that was no dogs allowed. And the jury did not rule in their favor, came back in favor of the condo association.
First world problems.
But the Geraci said, "That's okay. because we paid $8.63 million to buy the 6,000-square-foot penthouse at the Ritz-Carlton, and they have their own elevator that'll go right to the top of their floor.
Wow.
So they don't have to ride it with the peasants or plebeians.
So all those infomercials paying off. $8.63 million.
They beat out the Mexican billionaire. Was it Carlos?
Slim?
Yeah, to have the rights to that unfinished
40th floor. I don't think it
was
Carlos Slim, but
it was the other Mexican billionaire.
That is ironic that they had a dog and waived the dog rights, and then the dog ends up biting her. So there you have it. Anything I may have missed on Legal Faceoff? Anything we didn't get to?
Blackhawks out. Bulls
teetering.
About to be out.
That'd be the second year in a row that the UC didn't have a home playoff game in May.
Wow.
Wow, look at that stat, Sam.
Not good for the local economy on the west side. There.
No, it's not.
Not good for scalpers, for the vendors, or for the sports community.
Or for Jerry Reinsdorf for Rocky Wirtz.
Do we think any changes are imminent? I mean,
well, they fired Q's best friend.
Yeah, they fired his best friend and the coach of the Rockford team. That was really a good move. That's blame him.
Well, you saw what happened.
It was the Ice Hogs' fault.
They made a couple trades this year, the Blackhawks, and the head coach was tweeting out that he didn't like the trades.
Yeah, I saw that.
So that's why.
Is Q next? What if another first round? What if the Hawks don't make the playoffs at all next year?
There's derision right now between Bowman and Q.
Yeah.
So if they don't go far next year, who knows?
That was a really nice speech. It was Bowman that gave that speech, right, about how it's my fault, bad leadership.
He's very monotone, though. I'm angry.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed.
Unacceptable.
This is a complete failure.
Yeah. Darling, where's Darling going? Darling's going to be the starting goaltender somewhere next season.
Yeah.
Right?
Some people want him to trade Crawford, though.
Yeah, I would. I could see that.
So we'll see. For Rich and Jason, I'm Sam. Thanks to Craig Collins, as always, for producing this. This is Legal Faceoff. You can listen at WGNRadio.com. Check out anything you may have missed, WGNRadio.com. We're on iTunes as well. So we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.